Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Tuesday, April 27th. Before we start our agenda, would you please call the roll?
Representative Levy?
Before you continue the roll, would everybody who is not a member of the committee please mute your microphone and turn off your camera? We invite you to turn your camera on as well as your microphone when we call on you to testify. But until then, camera off, mic off. I still see some cameras on. And here's some mics on. You can please continue with the roll committee roll call, though. Thank you.
Levy present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is present by video.
Representative Smith.
Excused. He'll be joining us, but he's excused right now.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the House Committee on Revenue. We have four bills to hear today, four public hearings. And once again, if you are not a member of the committee, would you please turn your camera off and your mic off? We have our Legislative Revenue Office staff members with us and the committee members. And as we call on you to testify, please turn your mic on and your camera on. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2008A. Legislative Revenue Office, will you please briefly introduce this before we call our first speaker?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern for the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2008A provides tax exemption for property of religious organizations for low-income housing, and it also sets up some restrictions and conditions that the local governments may place on the development of the affordable housing by these same entities.
Thank you. Committee, any questions for LRO before we call on our witnesses for the public hearing? Thank you. I don't see any hands. Our first speaker is, Representative Reschke. I see a hand up now.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and apologize. I'm just a little slow with the controls today. Ms. McGovern, could you tell me how long this exemption goes for? Is it forever? Is it got a time limit on it, or do we know that? Well, I think you're on mute.
I'm so sorry. My apologies. Vice Chair Reschke. Chair Nathanson, property tax exemptions, and in this case, I believe, are meant to be processed on an annual basis, given that the usage of the property fits within the context of the statute if the bill were to be passed. We already have some statutes for low-income housing. For instance, if you were to build and develop, and those have some terms, but this would be religious property that is already owned potentially by the religious institutions. And so it's a little bit of a different part of the statute.
Just a quick follow-up then, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you. So Ms. McGovern, I'm trying to understand. I know most of our tax credits are 6 years. I know this is an exemption, which is different. And so I'm just trying to figure out, is there a time limit on this, or is there, it just goes until we repeal it?
Vice Chair Reschke, Chair Nathanson, unless I understand differently after the public hearing and in doing a little more work, it's year by year. There isn't a say 20-year period of an exemption or 10-year set exemption.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Good. Our first speaker will be Speaker Kotek, Representative Tina Kotek.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and colleagues. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek. I'm the state representative for House District 44, proudly representing North and Northeast Portland, and I'm also Speaker of the House. Thank you for taking up House Bill 2008A today. This bill came about, obviously, by the crisis that we're that's across the state in terms of the availability and, of enough affordable housing for Oregonians who need it. There is a church in my district, and if you go back to my testimony in the Housing Committee, it'll give you a little bit more background, but there's a church in my district who wanted to build low-income housing, and it took them 5 years to do it. So there's two components to this bill. One was to streamline, and that's the portion that we dealt with in House Housing, which is the streamlining and the zoning requirements to try to fast track, you know, these properties for churches and faith communities, not just churches, but all faith religious organizations who own property as part of their mission, want to convert it to very low income housing and make it easier for them. So that's one portion of the bill. And then in the course of putting the bill together, this church in my district was told, oh, well, since you had to subdivide your property and you want to build affordable housing, that's not actually a charitable activity under court precedent to allow you to get a tax exemption. And obviously that affects their ability to do it because the standard for the affordable housing is 60% of median income. It also requires a 60-year covenant. So this is a serious commitment to do this with your property. And if you think about your, some of, you know, if you're like my district, you have these kind of old line churches that have a lot of property. Those are the types of folks we're talking about here that want to convert some of their property to affordable housing. So what do you do with the property tax exemption? So the A4 amendment that is posted does address the property tax portion of the bill. We had some feedback that there needed to be clarity on the definition of the exemption. So that's primarily what the A4 does. It also allows that when this property tax exemption would go into effect on July 1 of this year, if for some reason you didn't know about it and you had to file late for that exemption, you wouldn't face a filing fee to do that. I will say, and I'm glad Eric from City Bend is hoping to testify, there has been some question about, okay, there's very light oversight on this property tax exemption. What's the best way to handle it? And honestly, I'm glad you're looking at it. So is it a annual reporting from the entity? Is it something more? I don't think we have to go as far as like a clawback provision. You're talking about a narrow number of properties that are already existing, owned by these organizations for conversion into affordable housing. So I am looking for your guidance on how we can strengthen maybe some of the oversight on the property tax portion. I'm open to that. I just really didn't know which way to go there, and leave that up to you because that's what you do in this committee. So that's I just encourage you to support it if you can. We have acres and acres of property currently owned by religious organizations across the state who want to convert their properties to affordable housing. They need a faster time frame, and this property tax exemption will also allow them to pencil it out at the requirements that are in the bill. So thank you for your time. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
I just like holding up my hand, but I don't have a question at this time. Thank you.
Okie dokie. Any other questions for Speaker Kotek? I don't see any right now.
I'll hang out for a few minutes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Yes, please stay with us however long you can. Our next speaker is Eric Kanzler. For this bill and the next two bills, I'm hoping that our witnesses can keep their comments to roughly 3 minutes each, 3 minutes or so. I would very much like to complete the list of all the witnesses who've signed up for all of the hearings today. So, Mr. Kanzler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke, and members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler. And although normally I am engaged with Speaker Kotek's housing bills on behalf of the City of Bend, in this case, I'm here on behalf of the county assessors, looking at the property tax administration side of the bill, as Speaker Kotek just mentioned previously. So I'm going to keep the comments fairly focused just on the administrative component, because as she mentioned, there are some questions, and I heard Vice Chair Reschke also ask a question about what is the permanence, what is the level of ongoing oversight and accountability associated with this. So this bill does deviate a little bit from the normal means of administering a nonprofit housing property tax exemption for affordable housing. So the statute that the bill cites is 307-162, which includes a process for the approval of tax exemptions for a variety of organizations, including religious organizations. ORS 307-540 through 548 is more specific to the approval of tax exemptions for nonprofit affordable housing. The provisions in the bill are much simpler. As we understand ORS 307-162, it really is only a one-time application and approval up front, rather than the standard annual application and approval as 540 through 548 describes, and it has no reporting requirement and it has no clawback provision standard within it. So 540-548 is more robust, but it does take a lot more work for the applicant and the property owner, for the approving agency, which in this case is either going to be a city or a county planning department, and ultimately for the assessor to administer. So either option would work, but we strongly suspect, based on previous conversations with Speaker Kotek, that the 540 to 548 option is going to be viewed as a little bit heavy-handed and burdensome here in this case. So what we would like to suggest for your consideration is sort of a hybrid option, where we stick with 307-162 as described in the bill, but include an annual reporting requirement where the property owner slash applicant every year would be letting the approving agency know, and also the assessors know, how many properties are qualifying for this exemption, because it does seem to appear, certainly in the dash A4, where it says on lines 2 to 4 of the second page, any portion of the property for any period during which the portion of the property is rented out as affordable housing to low-income individuals. This creates a scenario where, and Madam Speaker, she can correct me if I'm wrong, where you might have a unit that's only rented for part of the year for affordable purposes. So if that's the case, without a reporting requirement, how would the assessor know what the appropriate amount of property tax relief would be? So we would like to explore the reporting requirement. I was going to suggest consideration of a clawback mechanism as well. I think with a robust reporting requirement, that probably wouldn't be necessary. So I'll leave it at that. There's no one right answer. There are very many ways we could administer this. Just wanted to raise this issue and work through it collectively so that this tax break has the a well-considered oversight and accountability component. So I'll leave it at that and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kanzler. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kanzler, so in your scenario where you talked about somebody renting the dwelling for 6 months and then it not being rented for 6 months, how did the assessors then, is it prorated, or how is that applied?
So Madam Chair, Vice Chair Reschke, that's an excellent question. I don't know if Speaker Kotek is still on the committee, but I would be curious if she was, or if somebody could speak to the scenarios and the intent of the bill. Is that likely? Are we looking at people who would be renting for a month or 6 months or a period less than 1 year?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, happy to answer that. This is Representative Kotek again. You know, given the lack of housing, affordable housing supply out there, I would assume there would be a waiting list for these properties. I have to be very honest. At 60% income, I think it would be highly unlikely they would be vacant for more than a month at a time. I mean, there's always transition and things like that, but you know, this is a mission-driven project that, and these are the churches. The churches themselves are still the owners. They're not selling off the property. So it's very low income, a lot of need out there. I can't imagine we would have that situation, to be honest.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. So Madam Chair and Vice Chair Reschke, it sounds like the most likely scenario is that these units will be highly occupied and receiving basically a full year's worth of exemption. I do think there is a question on the margins potentially, or given the fact that this is an enduring property tax exemption that decades from now, hopefully less than that, we've been able to make a significant dent into these the affordability crisis. And I know we're hard at work trying to do that, but it is possible that we have, say, you know, if there's 80 units and 79 are occupied fully, what if one wasn't for a period of time? How would we partially assess that property? So I have to say that, and I haven't had a full chance to read the -A4, but I think there is a question of how we would do a partial exemption that I'm not able to answer at this point in time, but we can look into that quite quickly. And if a remedy is needed, I think we have means of ensuring the right methodology is applied to the bill.
Are there any other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I see Rep. Reschke has his hand up.
Are there any other questions from the committee?
We're going to take your button away, Vice Chair Reschke. So.
Thank you, Speaker Klotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues.
And Mr. Chancellor, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Manny, I'm confirming there are no other witnesses who have signed up for this bill.
That's correct.
Mr. Alanak or Ms. McGovern, any other comments before I close the public hearing on this bill?
Chair Nathanson, I just got a little bit of clarification from Legislative Council saying that, and you know, currently as it's written, and it sounds like there may be changes that the property could be held or used to provide affordable housing under the current writing of the bill. And that's
all. Thank you. Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2008. I'm opening the public hearing now on House Bill 2330.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, this is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. So I would think that a couple of background information will be helpful. So let me just go through very quickly. First, some school districts that house foreign exchange students in dormitories are eligible for receiving formula revenue because these students are considered resident students of the school districts. Currently, five school districts are receiving such revenue for about 40 students. And then second, the small school district grants of $2.5 million per school year, that's part of carve-outs from the state school fund, are designed to provide some additional operating revenues to districts with statutorily defined small high schools. Currently, there are around 80 school districts that qualify for these grants. And this bill also increases the weighted average daily membership, ADMW, cap of school districts with eligible high school, eligible small high schools from 8,500 to 9,500 to qualify for small school district grants. Small school district grants are commonly called small high school grants. Now, governing laws on these two that is small school district grants and school district funding for foreign exchange students are scheduled to sunset on June 30 this year. Actually, last year we extended the sunset for 1 year. Now it is set to sunset again. This bill removes the sunset completely. And that's the background issue. And then that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Committee members, are there any questions for LRO? Okay, let's move to our list of witnesses who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2330. As I call on you, please remember to turn on your camera and your microphone. And I'm hoping that you can complete your comments in about 3 minutes each. We have a 3-minute timer that we're using. I will tell you first the order of speakers so that you can prepare. Morgan Allen, Michael Carter, Skylar Evans, and Lou Lyon. So first, Morgan Allen.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. On behalf of the Coalition of Oregon School Administrators, COSA, I'm Morgan Allen, here to ask for your support for House Bill 2330. This bill comes to the Revenue Committee on a bipartisan unanimous vote of the House Education Committee with no known opposition, and I've been temporarily authorized to speak on behalf of OEA, OSBA, and OSEA to encourage you to vote for this. So that's probably the one time in history I'll get to speak for all of our organizations, but I'll take that opportunity. As Mr. Beck said, there are two things we're trying to take sunsets off. The first is we have five very small school districts, Mitchell, Spray, Ukiah, Burnt River, and Paisley. And a couple of members on this committee have those districts in their legislative districts. They are allowed to have a few foreign exchange students, but that ability to collect state school fund for those foreign exchange students expires at the end of this school year. And then there's about 80 school districts that divide about $2.5 million a year up that have small, rural, mostly small, mostly remote high schools. And that $5 million of biennium is also set to expire at the end of this biennium. So without legislative action, those 80 plus school districts will lose that funding. So House Bill 2330 removes the sunset provision, makes that funding permanent. For those of you that have been here for more than a session or two, you know we have to come back about every other session and extend the sunset. And so we've been doing that. So we thought this time we just asked the legislature to permanently remove it, again, because of the bipartisan support for the bill. And then the House Education did add one provision at the request of Representative Reschke. Klamath County, which is a very large school district, is just about at the maximum number of weighted students to get the small high school grant. But since they're so geographically spread out, they still have four very small high schools. And so we raised that number slightly so that the Klamath County School District and those small high schools can continue to get that funding. So we appreciate the support of the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, the most important thing is the legislature has to take action this session or these school districts will lose this very small amount, but very important amount of funding for their high schools. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Michael Carter.
Madam Chairman and Committee, thank you so much for having me this afternoon. I appreciate the time, and I won't take much more of your time. Mr. Allen covered this bill. It's one of those that the Oregon Small School Association, and I'm the executive director of 119 districts in the state, all the small ones get together, and some of the priorities we come up with, this is a number one priority that we have worked with the legislators over the years and been able to renew. We were hoping last year it would be sunsetted, and this year we really hope that you do that. It benefits schools, and I'm going to just give you the personal side. We're talking about a program here. So in a small school district, if we lose this small funding, it might be a small amount to the overall picture, but to a small district, it's a huge impact. And we could actually lose one of the programs, the CTE program, even though we have extra funding that you so graciously have provided us with. These programs are foundational to our operational you know, it costs more per student when you're running a small district because you have a overhead cost and, you know, it's not economy of scale. But it's so important for us. So I do hope you consider that. And we do endorse the, you know, the movement from 8,500 to 9,000 to help out the four schools in Klamath, because that community is needs that support as well. Dormitory schools, again, small amount, but it's very important for those communities. It's also a great way for our students in those small districts to be involved with the entire world. As we all know, we're part of the global society. So we thank you very much for your time. We do ask that you please support House Bill 2330. It's a monumental thing for us in the Oregon Small School Associations. Thank you for your time and continued support.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Skylar Evans.
Good afternoon, Chair Nancy Nathanson and members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Skylar Evans. I'm currently a senior at Burnt River High School in Unity, Oregon. I'm here today to tell my story about the foreign exchange student program at our school. During my junior year of high school, I was lucky enough to live in the dorm with our foreign exchange students. Because of the COVID pandemic, we're not able to have the program this year, but I really hope that our school can have it again next year. Me and my American friends learned so much from the foreign exchange students we went to school with last year. I learned even more than my friends because of living in the dorms with them. I learned more about the different places they came from and the differences in their cultures. Because I was exposed to those different cultures, I have a better understanding of how they do things differently than we do in America. I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't had the chance to live and go to school with these students. Because I was also exposed to so many different languages, I have an interest now in learning about other languages. The kids I lived with in the dorm were fun and interesting, and learning a little bit of their languages helped us to get to know each other better. And maybe most importantly, I developed lifelong family-like bonds with some of the foreign exchange students who were lucky enough to come to Burnt River schools last year. And I know the program was really beneficial to them too. Like me, they all learned about different cultures and they also got to improve their English speaking skills. That's going to help them get into colleges in the US, which is something they all wanted to do. I think it helps the teachers at our school too. Since some of the exchange students didn't speak English very well, teachers had to adapt and figure out the best way to teach each individual student based on their English language skills. That is my perspective of the program. It was a positive experience for me and my American friends, and it was also a great experience for the foreign exchange students as well as the teachers. I hope that you'll do what you can to make sure the program continues so others can experience it like I did. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Evans, thank you for your testimony. I very much enjoyed hearing from you about your experience.
You're welcome.
The next is Lou Lyon.
Good afternoon, Chair Nancy Nathanson and members of the House Revenue Committee. I am Lou Lyon, Superintendent of Burnt River School District 30J. On behalf of our school district and community of Unity, Oregon, we urge your support of House Bill 2330. Our district is unique in terms of what this proposed legislation means to our high school. We rely heavily on revenue provided through this legislation, and the loss of that revenue may very well be the death knell for our high school. If the proposed legislation does not pass, we will be forced to eliminate at least two of our three high school teachers and many co-curricular and extracurricular activities, thereby leaving our five local high school students to make the choice of continuing in an online blended program without traditional Burnt River School District activities or travel 45 to 48 miles one way twice per day to a neighboring community to continue their education. If those students choose to travel to another district, we will not need a high school teacher, so all three positions will be eliminated. As the superintendent of Burnt River School District, I'm proud to say that our school consistently produces strong and capable students. In addition to mastery of current curriculum standards, they have been exposed to a high degree of multiculturalism. This is often not the case in rural or even frontier schools such as ours. We are unique in that our small district has hosted, on average, 7 foreign exchange students per year for the last decade. This does wonders to increase the level of multiculturalism in our small community as well. I have witnessed our local students develop deep levels of friendship and respect with our visiting students. Over the years, Burnt River School District has experienced diminished enrollment, which presents a challenge of epic proportion for our school. If we lose our high school, we lose the amazing benefit that our students, both local and foreign, in our community realize because of the programs that would not be funded through House Bill 2330. It is for these reasons that I ask you to share our story with your colleagues and seek their support for passing this critical legislation. It is truly imperative for our students, our school, and our community as a whole. Chair Nancy Nathanson and members of the House Revenue Committee, thank you for your consideration and support of this matter.
And thank you as well for your testimony. We have a question or comment. Representative Smith. Representative Smith.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a point of history, about 6 years ago, our Speaker of the House, Representative Kotek, was gracious enough to enter into an agreement with the Burnt River School District to do a student exchange where students from Roosevelt High School in Portland could go to Burnt River, and students in Burnt River could go to Roosevelt. And while not many students took advantage of the opportunity, those who did found it very, very enriching. So just a point of history to share with you about the Burnt River School District. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Rep. Smith. Any other questions or comments from the committee? To everyone who testified, thank you very much. Representative Levy.
I just have a comment. The school that's in Ukiah, my sister-in-law has been a teacher there for about 15 or 20 years, and it's quite a school. And it's considered one of the top schools where international students come and spend a year and live there. Some of them will come back for a couple of years because they've had such a wonderful experience there.
That's good to know. Thank you, Rep. Levy. Anything else from the committee? Anything from LRO before I close the public hearing on House Bill 2330?
Don't have any.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think there might be another.
Rep. Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions. I'm curious if I am understanding this correctly, for the small school district fund, for the supplement fund, it sounds like the $2.5 million would be transferred from the state school fund. Is that correct? And could someone explain that a little bit more if that is a new permanent change?
So this is DABAC, Legislative Revenue Office. So it is so-called a carve-out from the state school fund. So what happens is we used to set aside $2.5 million every year from the state school fund and use that money for small school district grants. Now, that's been there forever, as far as I remember. And the sunset has been extended, moved to sometimes 4 years, sometimes a year, but has been continuing. The same about the foreign exchange students being considered as resident students. That started in 2010-11. And statutorily, the cap is set at 47 because that's the number That was the number in 2010 and 11. So the number cannot go above 47, and the number actually hovered around 40 every year.
A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you for that additional information. That's helpful. I guess I'm just to clarify then, for the grants that have previously been given from the $2.5 million, this doesn't change that amount, correct? This would just be continuing that in an ongoing way. So wouldn't be, I guess to clarify, sorry, it wouldn't be further decreasing the state school fund.
So the back legislative revenue office, no, that 2.5 has been 2.5 million every year for almost two decades. And the figure hasn't been changed. And that's it's been there actually, and so there's no inflation escalation clause or anything like it. It's just 2.5 every year, 5 million biennium. That figure has been set there, hasn't changed over the years.
Great, thank you. One more question, if I may, Chair Nathanson.
And Representative Smith after that.
Great, thank you. I was also just curious about the ADMW increase, and if you can share a little bit about why that is necessary for the increase in residents.
So they back legislative revenue office. So in 2019, with the lead of Vice Chair Rushke, the ADMW cap for qualifying for small high school correction, so-called small high school correction, it went from 8,500 to 9,500. So what this bill is doing it actually is trying to be consistent with that change throughout the statutes. So in one place, small high school has a cap of 8,500 ADMW for the school district that small high school belongs to, and then in other places 9,500, making it consistent, so to speak.
Got it. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Representative Smith. Representative Smith?
Sorry, I have it on mute again, darn it. It might be worthwhile, Madam Chair, for us to go back and get a little bit of history. If I recall correctly, and this is going back 20 plus years, this amount of money was part of a negotiated agreement as part of a larger education package. And at the time, it was done in a bipartisan manner in which, if I remember correctly, our good teachers in the Oregon Education Association, along with the school board folks and a lot of other entities, came on board to support this effort. And it's unfortunate that in that legislation, we didn't put a COLA adjustment, because as was just shared with us from our legislative revenue professionals, the number's been sitting the same number for 20 years, which obviously means its value to the schools has been devalued. And so it'd be interesting to get a little bit of a historical reminder as to how this came to be, because I think we had all see there was a real mutual collaboration that brought this to be. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Anything else from the committee? Mr. Alanak, anything before we close this hearing on House Bill 2330?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2330. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2781.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 2781 would authorize the county court to order tax collector to cancel the property taxes that were assessed on property at the request of the tax collector when the district attorney determines that the taxes are wholly uncollectible. We had a little bit of conversation in a previous committee meeting about delinquencies and foreclosures and some of the timing on that. And this is related to property taxes that haven't been paid.
Okay. Thank you for that introduction. Committee, any questions for LRO before we start the witness list? We have five people signed up to speak. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McGovern, in the description, it says upon the request of tax collector and district attorney. So I'm assuming both of those have to agree before this can be exempt. Is that correct? It's an and statement, not an or.
My apologies. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. For this one also, we hope that you can complete your testimony, get your ideas across to us within 3 minutes or so. We have five people signed up to testify. I first would like to call on Representative David Brock Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair's colleagues, David Brock Smith, for your record, State Representative, House District 1. I bring you this at the request, this bill at the request of the special districts, and I will turn it directly over to Mark Landauer and your other members, Madam Chair, so we can expedite your committee.
Thank you, Representative Brooks. The next speaker signed up to testify is Coos County Commissioner Melissa Cribbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will also be brief. I am testifying today just as a matter of policy. We, as county commissioners, have a big concern about opening floodgates when we start talking about canceling back taxes. Most of our taxpayers who have back taxes would, in fact, like them to be canceled. And so we have had the opportunity to review the proposed Dash 1 amendments. My fellow commissioners, county commissioners, feel that that does narrow it enough that we would no longer be in opposition. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today and providing your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next is Mark Landauer, followed by Margaret Barber and Michelle Bradley. So, Mr. Landauer.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer, and I appear before you as the Executive Director of the Oregon Public Ports Association. I want to thank Chair Nathanson for making the time to hear this bill and also for having the Dash 1 amendment proposed and put before you. Excuse me. Last summer, our association worked with several stakeholders, the counties, the cities, the assessors, on an issue that has been hampering a few of our ports over the years. In a couple of instances, we have two ports who will testify before you describing some circumstances upon which property taxes became uncollectible. All methods of collection were pursued and those efforts failed. As a result, you have ports that have outstanding property, real property taxes on properties that could very well be put to use, but for the fact that there is a remaining property tax attached to that property. Some of the challenges that are created due to these unpaid property taxes are that it creates an administrative burden for the ports as well as the assessors. They must continue to keep these outstanding balances on the books, and those accounts continue to accrue interest over time. It also limits the ability of ports to fulfill their mission, which is to spur economic development in the state. A property with an outstanding property tax balance cannot be sold because an assessors are prohibited from recording a sale of a property unless and until all real property taxes have been satisfied. As a result, these ports are limited in their ability to fully explore economic development opportunities of those properties unless and until those taxes have been satisfied, which brings me to really the final point. As public bodies, our ports don't believe that their taxpayers should be held liable for the third party's outstanding real property tax liability, especially if all collection attempts have been made and exhausted. Simply put, to us, it makes no sense that taxpayers of a port district should have to satisfy the outstanding property tax bill of a third party. I would like to note just very briefly for the committee, we became aware today that the Dash 1 amendment may very well apply to a couple additional properties located in Lincoln County. That was not our intent. Our intent was really to confine this to two properties, one at the International Port of Coos Bay and one at the Port of Tillamook. I will be happy to work with those parties to try to narrow the focus of the amendment if the committee is so inclined to move something forward. And with that, I'd like to introduce Margaret Barber, the External Affairs Manager for the International Port of Coos Bay, and Michelle Bradley, who's the General Manager of the Port of Tillamook Bay and the current President of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Landauer. And next, I will call on Margaret Barber.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Barber. I'm the Director of External Affairs and Business Development for the Port of Coos Bay. It's my pleasure to speak with you today regarding HB 2781 and its importance to the port. This bill is intended to remedy an issue that arose back in 1991 that persists to this day. So in 1991, the port entered into a lease agreement with the U.S. Coast Guard for the port-owned citrus dock here in Coos Bay. At that time and until 2013, ORS 307.166 required the tax-exempt entities file an application for exemption. In what I'm sure was an oversight, the Coast Guard neglected to file this application until 1993. This resulted in a tax liability which remained unpaid by the Coast Guard. The tax liability was transferred to the port at the conclusion of this lease, and as a result, the tax and interest that has accrued over the past 30 years, the current liability the port has on that property is nearly $25,000. Coos County has indicated that they are statutorily unable to waive the tax or interest per ORS 311.785. Through discussions with the Oregon Department of Revenue, short of seeking legislative changes to the statutes, the port is stuck with either paying everything or have the taxes and interest continue to remain in place and interest continue to collect. Please note that in 2013, the legislature amended ORS 307.166 so that an application for exemption is no longer required if an entity is normally tax exempt. Under ORS 307.040, applying to the federal government, or ORS 307.090, which applies to states, counties, ports, etc. Even though the Coast Guard would have been eligible for the exemption in 1991, because they did not actually file until 1993, they were liable for taxes prior to when they were granted the exemption, and the county does not have the authority to waive any part of that. The Coast Guard submitted an appeal approximately 20 years later, but was also not successful. We're respectfully requesting that you consider support of HB 2781 with the Dash 1 amendments, which offers a common sense one-time fix for this specific tax liability impacting the port. To clarify the intent of the bill, we want to ensure that ownership The word ownership that's referenced in line 6 of the bill refers to ownership of the tax liability itself. With the existing liability in place, the port's ability to effectively market the site to promote new potential growth and investment in the area is significantly diminished. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Michelle Bradley.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. I agree everything that Mark and Margaret have said. I don't want to reiterate that in consideration of time. My name is Michelle Bradley. I'm the general manager here at the Port of Tillamook, and I'm also the current president of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Thank you for allowing the testimony today on House Bill 2781 and the -1 amendment. Our situation is a little different. As far as history, we have about 1,600 acres that's a vacated former Naval Air Station. So when it was vacated, the Navy deeded it to the county, and then the county later deeded it to the port. So we have some very large acreages that are considered one tax lot here. So that then has created such an issue of a tenant that does not has not paid their taxes, then limits the port on purchasing or on selling other property. So we've had two different instances of trying to sell a parcel that is miles away from where a tenant was that didn't pay their taxes. The reason that those never got resolved was either bankruptcy or death of the tenant. So they are just uncollectible. We don't know where these folks are. It's specific in our specific instance. It's an outstanding amount of just under $19,000 for the original taxes. Interest has creeped up over the years for over almost $30,000, for a total of just under $50,000 total liability to the Port of Tillamook for some of these. Those are our specific circumstances. I don't know if there's any questions. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And other than that, I would urge you to support 2781 with the -1 amendment. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. I want to confirm, Manny, are there any others who signed up to testify at the last minute after the list was printed?
No, Madam Chair.
That concludes the witnesses for today's public hearing. Committee members, any questions for the witnesses? LRO, any comments before I close this public hearing?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2781. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3167.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 3167 in the A version repeals the sunset of the Predator Damage Control District Program, and so there are predator control districts in several parts of the state, and this began in 2015, and this bill would remove that sunset.
Thank you. There are a number of people who have signed up to speak. This is a reminder to keep your cameras off and your mics off until you're called on to testify. We have a long list of speakers, and it appears that some of you have had an opportunity to testify in a previous committee at a previous hearing. We have 20 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, at least 15. I'm hoping for 20, but about 10 people to speak. I'm going to ask you to limit your comments to 2 minutes each and hope that that's sufficient. We invite you to send your written testimony to us if there's something that you wanted to say that you couldn't complete the ideas or the comments. You're welcome to send us your written testimony up until 24 hours after this committee meeting started. Let's start with Representative David Brock-Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, colleagues. Again, for your record, State Representative David Brock-Smith, House District 1, which encompasses Southwest Oregon from Charleston down to the California border, at Brookings Harbor over to West Cape Junction, up West I-5 to West Roseburg, and back over to the coast. I bring you today a critical bill for my district and other places around the state. As mentioned in the intro, again, this would just remove the sunset of these predator damage control districts. And I just want to close with this management includes non-lethal measures already. So folks that are concerned about that, it's already in statute. So appreciate the opportunity. And we worked this in my Ag and Natural Resources Committee, moved it out, came over here because it is self-funded and had a tie. And thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And please, you're welcome to stay with us in case questions come up later. But we want to be sure to try to get to everybody who's testified rather than hold over a remaining one or two people to speak on a different day that might be inconvenient for them. Representative Marsh. Representative Marsh, I see your hand is up.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I'm Rep. Brock-Smith. A question. You discussed the non-lethal elements of the program, and you said, I think, that that's already in statute, but that's not a state statute around this program at this point, is it? Or can you point to it?
Well, I apologize if I misspoke. The management of the ODF&W department under this program is that there's already both lethal and non-lethal measures that are used.
In practical matter, but not in statute.
Thank you for correcting the record.
Thank you.
Are you working on an amendment to this bill, Representative?
We usually don't have a back and forth dialogue. This is for public testimony at the public hearing at this point in time. The next speaker will be Melissa Cribbins, please, Coos County Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will also try to be brief on this one. Coos County is one of the poorest counties in the state, and I think that you'll find that most of the counties where this voluntary predator control district is implemented are the poorer counties with very little discretionary money. We try to use our discretionary funds very carefully. And so when I became a commissioner, we were actually in the process of talking about phasing out animal control. We just could not afford to fund it anymore. And the landowners have come forward and they're voluntarily making these payments in order to keep that service available. I think the thing that we find also is that when the services are available, they're also used to help just our everyday citizens. I had a citizen call me a couple of years after I became a commissioner to tell me about how grateful she was for this service because there had been a cougar stalking her two young children out of their playhouse. They lived in rural Oregon, didn't have any, you know, cattle or sheep, but there was a cougar in the area and it was stalking her two young children. And the trapper came out and took care of it very quickly before the children were their pets were injured. And we don't always think of that aspect of it, but it's an important service that they provide. Thank you.
Thank you again, Chair Cribbins. The next witnesses, I'll name you, I'll list you in order so that you can start preparing. It will be Jim Carr, Tristy Kamal, Samantha Brueger, Dan Dawson, Elisa Tau, Lauren Smith, Brian Posewitz, Marianne Cooper, Amy Patrick, Tony Brumbach, and Kyle Williams. So next, let's hear from Jim Carr. Jim Carr.
Hi, this is Jim Carr. Do you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to share with you a little bit. I am currently the chair of the Coos County Predator Damage Control District, and prior to the formation of the district, after Caddy McEwen provided the opportunity for the counties to and the landowners to proceed with the program under their own funding, I had worked with an advisory board with the commissioners and in Coos County to try to provide the funding, and it became very evident that through the resources available to the county, as Commissioner Cribbins mentioned, were just minimal and would not be able to continue. And so the formation of this has just been real valuable to our district area for the landowners to participate. And as she said, it also makes the availability for public nuisance and other issues that come up where there would actually be a wildlife services specialist in the area. Without the program, there will probably not be that opportunity within the county. There would have to be somebody that would come in from somewhere else, and it probably would not be timely. And I will yield my time to others that want to speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Srishti Kamal.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Srishti Kamal, and I'm the Senior Northwest Representative for Defenders of Wildlife, which is a national wildlife conservation organization. On behalf of Defenders and our nearly 33,000 members in Oregon, I would like to submit the following comments on House Bill 3167. Currently, there is no language in the program for non-lethals, except for under Wildlife Services Directive, which is the agency receiving the contracts and not ODFNW. Defenders strongly feels that the bill should make provisions for non-lethals explicitly and make resources available for landowners to use such tools. One of the main goals of the program is to reduce conflict with livestock, and there is substantial evidence that shows the outcome of lethal control is often uncertain and ineffective in the long run because it is dependent on several other environmental factors such as prey density, population density of the species, landscape and terrain type, etc. If you remove a predator from an area, it is merely creating a vacant territory for other individuals of the species to occupy. So killing an individual creates a vicious cycle of just killing carnivores repeatedly for simply the ecological role they play in the ecosystem. Additionally, there is scientific evidence that lethal removal of a predator does not increase tolerance towards the species. In fact, it does the opposite. It normalizes culling of a species, sends a negative message on the value of the species for the society, and increases acceptability of poaching. Killing endlessly cannot be the solution, so we urge you to consider making amendments in the program that would add considerations on implementing non-lethal methods first, and also resources for such tools for landowners. If such considerations need further discussion, then we ask that you extend the sunset for another 6 years while those details are worked out. Ultimately, for humans and wildlife to coexist, and especially with carnivores, we have to look at conflict prevention and not reaction after a conflict has occurred. Lethal control is a reaction, and to sustain Oregon's wildlife, we have to move past reactionary behavior. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next is Samantha Brueger.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Samantha Brueger. I live in Salem and I work as Wildlife Coexistence Campaigner for Wild Earth Guardians. My organization counts 4,237 Oregonians as members. As written, Wild Earth Guardians is opposed to HB 3167. While its proponents state that this bill is simply This bill simply provides a means to tax for a district to manage lethal and non-lethal predator control. This bill would institutionalize wildlife services in Oregon. While wildlife services can perform non-lethal activities, as it was mentioned in previous testimony, the fact of the matter is that they killed 10,577 native wild animals in Oregon just last year. If this bill is intended to enable all methods of wildlife conflict management, including non-lethal technical solutions from nonprofits and other contractors, it must be amended to expressly include non-lethal language. Passing this bill as written would perpetuate the myth that these carnivores need to be killed or controlled. Scientific research shows that non-lethal coexistence solutions are more effective at preventing wildlife damage, more environmentally sustainable, and more cost-effective over time. It is the hope of Wild Earth Guardians that this committee will amend the bill to include non-lethal wildlife conflict solutions and add language that prioritizes non-lethal solutions for its long-term cost-effectiveness and sustainability. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next is Dan Dawson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dan Dawson. I live here in Douglas County, and we run a sheep, cattle, and goat ranch just outside the city limits here of Roseburg. I currently serve as the Douglas County Livestock Association Predator Control Chair and on the advisory committee here to the Predator District that is currently operating here in Douglas County. I'm also on the National Wildlife Service Advisory Committee in Washington, D.C. I serve in that role also. I'm here to testify in favor of the committee on House Bill 3167 to remove the sunset and get this back, keep what we have going. I'm one of the original writers of the bill from 2015 when we originally worked on this. Our intent was for funding. We were trying to, as a rancher here in Douglas County, we get a lot of predator problems, and we had no one to do it. We didn't have the money to keep the program going, so we started these districts. We went from three trappers down to two, and we also have two non-lethal specialists that operate in our area in the Southwest District. I was involved with NRDC, which is the Natural Resource Defense Council, on bringing money to work with these non-lethal specialists in our area. I just want to thank you guys for listening to us and taking the time, and I would be glad to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Next is Elisa Taw, followed by Lauren Smith.
So.
You're on mute. Could you unmute the microphone, please?
Am I okay now?
Yes.
Okay. It's Alyssa Thorpe, but that's fine. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Thorpe. I live east of Roseburg, Douglas County. I raise sheep on the Buckhorn Road. I have a USDA label Magnolia Farms lamb, which is grass raised and grass finished. I supply lamb weekly to the Ashland Food Co-op year round, and this is my 21st year of doing business with them. It's a partnership I'm really proud of. I'm a sole proprietor, and in addition to my farm, I lease a neighboring ranch. Being able to call on help from our county trappers is of great importance in my operation, not just for the safety of the animals in my care, but also for my personal safety. My major predators are cougar and bear. One of my guardian dogs has been killed by a bear, and a couple of years ago, I had a cougar taking lambs from my barn. During lambing, my lambing barn's approximately 150 yards from my house. I do believe in living with wildlife. And animals I ask for help with are animals that have proven to be difficult and impossible to discourage by other means. Like many ranchers in Douglas County, I use as many non-lethal methods as possible to discourage predators.
electric fencing, rotation of my sheep where predator pressure is strong, and that's quite often seasonal, and most important for me, livestock guardian dogs. I believe we all appreciate the beauty of our environment here and the privilege it is to farm and ranch, providing food for people, especially utilizing the beautiful grasslands of Douglas County and stewarding our lands to the highest standards. Thank you for your time and consideration on this matter, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you. Next is Lawson Smith.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of AB 3167. For the record, I am Lauren Smith, and I'm the Natural Resources Legislative Affairs Manager for the Association of Oregon Counties, and we represent Oregon's 36 county governments. Many rural Oregonians rely on effective predator management to prevent costly depredation on their livestock or timber, and predator damage control districts provide a voluntary mechanism for agriculture and timber producers to maintain the effectiveness of current predator control services within the county without imposing a tax on the general public. These districts give producers the ability to contribute to the funding of the county's trapping program and free up county funds to go to other county services, including law enforcement and infrastructure improvements. Landowners in our rural counties absolutely need the sunset on the successful predator control district pilot program lifted for the current programs in Coos and Douglas County to continue to help fund all work related to predator management, from education to non-lethal deterrence to removal of problem predators. It is important to note that the bill doesn't create any new predator control program and authorize anything new in regard to predator management. In forming a predator control district, landowners are taxing themselves to fund an existing, very long-standing and well-known predator control program. This then allows the counties to redirect funds historically used for predator control programs to other public services. So we respectfully request your support of HB 3167 as predator control districts play a vital role in helping Oregon's rural counties fund important public services for their constituents. Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker is Brian Posowitz.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for the chance to testify. My name is Brian Posowitz. I'm here today on behalf of Humane Voters Oregon. We oppose House Bill 3167 in its present form because, along with some other speakers you heard, we don't think the program that this bill would make permanent adequately authorizes or prioritizes non-lethal measures to address wildlife damage conflicts. We also think the program should have another sunset instead of being made permanent, given the limited track record of the program, which is two districts over 6 years with limited formal reporting on how the money raised was spent or on its effectiveness. We did submit written comments on behalf of ourselves and four other groups, and I hope you'll have a chance to look at those. Just as a practical matter, what these districts do is they raise money for counties to pay the Federal Wildlife Services Program to address conflicts between people and so-called predatory animals. In this case, predatory animals includes, once you wade through all the various cross-references, bears, bobcats, foxes, cougars, quote, fur-bearing mammals, gray wolves, coyotes, rabbits, and rodents. Nothing in the existing program says anything about whether the money raised by these districts can or should be used for non-lethal approaches to wildlife management before resorting to lethal measures. And just in terms of what non-lethal tools might be used, there's a report attached to our testimony in House Ag and Natural Resources from a Benton County program that used the non-lethal tools. And they can include things like fencing, protective housing, electronic scare devices, both lights and sound, guard dogs, and apparently guard donkeys. You will hear that Wildlife Services already uses and prioritizes non-lethal tools, but I've read their guidelines and I don't think there's anything prescriptive there that requires consideration or use of those. And our information from people close to the program is that Wildlife Services does emphasize lethal measures and often fails to adequately consider non-lethal measures. So we, along with the other speakers, would just ask that if this bill moves forward, that it be amended to explicitly authorize use of the funds for non-lethal measures, and that there be some requirement that those be considered and used where appropriate before resort to lethal measures. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Of the next speakers. Would you please turn off the mic? Thank you. We have reached the ending time for our committee. I'm going to ask the committee members, can you stay another 8 minutes or less if we can hurry this along? We have four more speakers, and of those four, three have already spoken at a previous hearing, so they might have more succinct comments today, not sure. The next is Marianne Cooper.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, Marianne Cooper here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We were one of the primary proponents of creating this predator control district program in 2015. And as you've heard, the bill before you today simply removes the sunset on that program and allows it to be made permanent. As other speakers have said, the Predator District Control Program is simply a means for landowners to assess themselves to help fund their share of wildlife services funding at the county level. It passed out of its policy committee with a do pass recommendation. We do not see a revenue impact to this bill. So I'll spend a little bit of time just talking about some of what you've heard today. Wildlife Services does follow an integrated approach to wildlife management, and that includes always evaluating whether or not non-lethal controls are sufficient, looking to educate landowners, and only doing lethal control when needed. I also wanted to point out 95% of the work done by Wildlife Services is management of invasive species. And of the number that seemed probably quite large, 10,000 plus that you heard this year alone, I will point out that 5,500 of those were squirrels, presumably in urban areas causing damage to homeowners and other property damage that squirrels can cause. Another couple thousand were birds, I think, similarly causing urban damage. So by no means are, you know, for our landowners, they are already doing all they can on non-lethals, and lethal measures is always the last resort. However, it is very important as a tool in the toolbox for our landowners when it is needed. And we think this program should be broadly supported because it is an instance of landowners paying for this service themselves on a voluntary basis. And not looking to increase state dollars, not looking to increase general tax dollars from the county for that service. So we strongly encourage you to remove the sunset and move this bill forward. We are able to have additional conversations about non-lethal controls, but I will say the language that we've seen by proponents, we think opens counties up to litigation risk that we can't afford at this time. So with that, thank you, and happy to take any questions.
People in line for testimony. Rep Marsh, we won't be able to complete the testimony if we get into a lot of questions, but do you have a quick question?
Just a very quick question, Chair Nathanson. Marianne, I wondered, since we have worked together to put together a brief amendment, if you would just quickly describe so that everybody knows what we're working on.
Yes, absolutely. Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, we have worked with Representative Marsh on an amendment that would clarify that the predator control district services that we're talking about here include non-lethal measures, and then make a number of other adjustments that were originally proposed in the base bill to the program, just for things that our folks noticed as they created these predator control districts, nothing super substantive on those.
Thank you for the question and succinct response. Next is Amy Patrick.
Good afternoon. I will be exceedingly brief, as we've also already testified on the bill. So for the record, my name is Amy Patrick, and I represent the Oregon Hunters Association, and we are simply here to support the bill that would repeal the sunset on the Predator Damage Control Program. We believe that this landowner-funded program is very worthwhile, and we'd like to see that maintained. And so we urge support of House Bill 3167, and that concludes my testimony. I'll yield my time back.
Thank you very much, Ms. Patrick. Tony Brumbach? Tony? In case there's a technical problem, I'm going to move quickly to Kyle Williams, and we'll come back to Tony if we get that connection. Kyle Williams.
Thanks, Chair Nathanson. You hear me okay?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay. Afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs, Simon Reschke. My name is Kyle Williams. I'm with the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. In the effort to be brief, I would just say that echo the sentiments from Farm Bureau and Marianne, and appreciate the work that she and Representative Marsh are hammering out right now on the amendment. Just want to voice support for removing the sunset in the bill 3167A, and echo the positive sentiments from all of our landowner representatives who've already spoken today. So thanks for the time.
Thank you for your testimony. And let's give it one last try. Tony Brumback, are you here?
Do you see him? He's even on the list?
No.
So would you send?
Excuse me, so, I'm hearing some conversation that I think is not meant for the committee public hearing. I don't see Tony trying to get in. LRO, does that complete the list for this afternoon, the list of witnesses?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. LRO, do you have any comments for us before we close the public hearing on House Bill 3167?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I think the only thing I would do is clarify that the way that the bill would work if the program did sunset is that the existing districts may not dissolve, but they would cease the ability to continue to assess fees on properties, and then no new districts would be able to be formed, absent the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much for that additional comment.
Thank you.
And I want to thank everybody who presented your testimony in a succinct way. I appreciate your patience with us so that we could hear from everybody. And I'm glad we were able to do that. Mr. Alanak, anything else before I close this public hearing?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3167. And any comments, Mr. Alanak, before we close this meeting today?
No, Madam Chair. I think you've completed your agenda for the day.
Okay. Committee, I'll see you at the next meeting. Thank you all. We're adjourned.